Hello, I'm Rob Wolf, author of The Alternate Universe. This is New Books in Science Fiction. And for anyone counting, it's our 76th episode and the 53rd that I've had the honor to host. Today is the Jade is Thicker Than Water episode, and I'm speaking with Fonda Lee, author of Jade City, which was shortlisted for this year's Nebula Award for Best Novel. Fonda actually had two books up for the Nebula this year. Her young adult novel, Exo, was a finalist for the Andre Norton Award. And in 2015, her debut novel, Zero Boxer, was also an Andre Norton Award finalist. Jade City is Fonda's first book specifically written for adult readers. It combines what I've heard her call the three M's, mafia, magic, and martial arts. And I am delighted that she's on the line with me now from her home in Oregon. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's good to be here.
It's great to have you. Jade City is set in the fictional island of Kaycon, which is governed both by a political body called the Royal Council and by traditional clans, which are gangster families, and they take loyalty oaths and they have honor codes, and they aren't afraid to resort to violence to maintain order. The world you've created has both familiar elements. There's a lot of mid-20th century tech, like televisions and landline phones. But the Kaycanese also have something very special, jade. So that's where I thought we should start. Can you talk about jade's importance in the story and the power it gives the Greenbones, who are the Kaycanese, who are the ones allowed to wear it and who are trained in the proper way to use it?
Yeah. So in many ways, Jade City was a wish fulfillment exercise for me because I have been practicing martial arts for a very long time, and I'm also a big fan of kung fu movies. And I felt like a lot of the movies that I watched were false advertising because I'd been training in martial arts for so long and was like, hey, this isn't fair. I can't run up walls. I can't leap from building to building. I can't do chi blasts. What is this? I felt kind of misled by all the amazing magical powers that the characters in martial arts films seem to exhibit that I could not achieve no matter how much training I put in. And I figured there must be, you know, this is the fantasy writer brain in me, deciding there must be some special factor, some magic element that's at work here that clearly I don't have access to. And I started sort of envisioning this idea of a world that was built around these amazing martial arts powers and how that would actually play out if I were to create a world where that made sense. And so Jade was very quickly the natural choice for me in terms of what's the magic substance that's like the X factor here. And the reason for that is, you know, fantasy literature has had this long tradition of magic substances. There's always the magic sword or magic crystal or gemstones. And in Eastern culture, jade is considered more valuable than any other substance. It's been referred to as the stone of heaven. It has this long tradition of being viewed with as a spiritual substance, a link between heaven and earth. So it was already figuratively magical in our world, in Eastern culture and history. So I made it literally magical in the fantasy world that I created of Kaycon. One of the things that I find frustrating / annoying about some fantasy stories is this idea that the magic is just given and you are sort of born with it, if you will, or you gain it. You get the magic sword and now you have the power. And as you know, any martial artist knows, achieving a level of proficiency involves a long, arduous amount of discipline and schooling. So what I wanted to do was kind of combine this idea of the magic substance with also a culture around training these characters who might be born with some innate ability to wear the jade, but still have to go through these years and years of training in order to be able to harness it. And there's a whole meritocracy around being able to tolerate the jade and to harness it, because if you don't have that ability, it also has these horrible side effects that can lead to madness and death.
Well, you have explained in the story that there are six disciplines that the Greenbone fighters develop their expertise in through this schooling process. Things like strength and steel, perception, lightness. There are a couple others, and it would be interesting to hear you talk a little bit about why you decided to emphasize these particular disciplines. And I assume perhaps, or perhaps not, some of that was informed by your own personal knowledge of martial arts. I'd be curious to hear how your own experience, and you've shared some of that now already with investment you've made in the training, has informed your invention of the art of using jade properly in your story.
So I came up with the six disciplines really as a kind of a way to explain and divide the types of superhuman powers that jade could endow someone with if they were properly trained. And when I had my book launch, I actually went through old kung fu movie clips and took little examples out of them to illustrate each of the six disciplines, because they really kind of come from or the magic abilities that you do see in kind of like the classic kung fu films and movies like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. So strength, right? You often see those characters who are able to just punch through a wall with a single punch, or you know, bend a steel bar. That was kind of an obvious one. Steel, you know, would be like the example of having the super invulnerability, right? You see the characters in action films like smash into a table and they break the table and they get up and they seem fine. Perception is that sort of magic sixth sense where you see the kung fu master go into some room and you know, he knows there's an assassin in the rafters because he can like sense another heartbeat in the room, or you know, he's able to fight blindfolded. So perception was kind of the embodiment of that. Deflection is almost like a telekinetic ability, right? It's the chi blast or the force powers that you see in like Star Wars, which are very much also derived from some of that tradition. And then we have lightness, running up the walls, leaping great distances, jumping from tree to tree, you know, that element. And which one am I missing?
Channeling.
And channeling. Right, channeling being kind of the energy flow, the chi blast, that sort of mystical fight. If you remember the end of Kill Bill, when the bride does the five strike, whatever it's called, and the person walks away and their heart bursts. So they're all very much derived from the magic, mystical martial arts powers that sort of form the basis of the more fanciful martial arts films and stories out there.
One thing that's interesting about your Greenbone characters is that these clans are also business enterprises. And it occurred to me, and in looking at your biography, that you've also had experience in business as a consultant before you dive full-time into writing. And I thought maybe some of these disciplines are also not only good for mano-a-mano battles, but for instance, perception might be something that's helpful in a business negotiation where you can tell if someone maybe isn't telling the truth.
Oh, definitely. I envisioned the clans as being really this both military and business organization. And a lot of the business maneuverings and negotiations and backroom dealings came as much from other mafia films that I've loved, like The Godfather, for example, where there's not overly large amount of violence. Yes, there's violence, But when it comes pretty suddenly and as this punctuation to a lot of this sort of backroom maneuvering and political conflict that's also going on. So the clans, as I envision them, have modernized in the sense that they are multifaceted, and they've got a lot of economic interests as well as military ones. And so I wanted the story to really proceed on all those levels, where the Jade Warriors, yes, they have these martial abilities, but they've also developed these networks that historically were used for military purposes, but have evolved into being really business networks and groups. And I think that those scenes were just as much fun and as much filled with as much tension as some of the action scenes.
The book's action centers on the Call family, who run the Nopeak clan. That's one of the largest clans on K'Kon, and the other large clan is the Mountain clan. And at one time, they were united in a war for independence, which they eventually won, but they end up over time, and ultimately in the course of your book, at war with each other. I thought we could talk a little bit about how the clans work and how their relationship and the culture of the island affects the main characters in your story, who are three biological siblings and an adopted sibling who are the next generation, the up-and-coming generation for the Nopeak clan. And they all seem to end up in roles that they don't exactly seem to want to be in or feel 100% comfortable in as the story goes on. But it seems as if custom and family ties and honor compel them to follow through in these roles. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that, about the kinds of conflicts that your main characters experience and the power of culture and custom in their lives.
Yeah, so that is a big question and very much part of the vision that I had from the book from the beginning, which is I knew from the start that this was going to be a story about family and that it would be about a new generation coming into power and dealing with the legacy of prior generations. So K'Kon is a post-colonial setting in that this was a country that was many years ago governed by a foreign occupying power. And at that time, the green-bone, jade-wearing warriors were a resistance organization. And after the foreign power was expelled from the island, they essentially became a ruling class because they had overthrown this oppressive foreign government, and they now had this whole network that used to be used for resistance fighting that got leveraged into business and rebuilding the country. And we come into the story at a period of time when the country is really kind of grown and expanded, and it's opening up to international trade, and that old war generation is dying out. And so you've got this this generation that is still very much influenced and rooted in the history and the nature of the clans, but has a whole new set of pressures. And in particular, that organization that was so united during foreign occupation has fractured into these two main clans that end up vying for power, political power, economic power, territory of the capital city, and so on. And so the characters are in the Call family are very much beholden to the fact that they're part of what is in their world almost a semi-royal status because they are part of this ruling family that were the war heroes in their grandfather's generation. And they are now coming into their own. And the eldest brother, Lon, has taken over the reins of leadership from his grandfather, who was this huge war hero, but is now in his 80s and so can't really lead anymore. And he has a younger brother who is the military leader really in the clan and is in charge of defending it from its rivals. And there's a prodigal daughter who has decided she wants to leave the clan behind and strike out on her own and be an independent, and is coming back to the island at a tense time. And then they have their younger adopted brother, Anden, who is a greenbone in training, and he's trying to figure out where he fits into the family and what he wants with his life. So those dynamics were sort of the heart of the story, because it's really the relationship between these four siblings that drives a lot of the emotional narrative and makes them act in the ways that they do and puts them all in the position that they're in. And as you noticed, and some of my other readers have noticed, they all end up having forced to do things they don't really want to do. And that is always a great place for an author to be in, when you get to really put your characters in a pressure cooker and torment them in ways that make your readers really worried for them. So that kind of combination of family drama and also sort of societal growth and change and the pull between modernity and tradition were all very much a part of the heart of this novel.
Shay, the prodigal daughter that you mentioned, is in some ways a familiar figure, the person who tries to go off on her own and strike out an independent life. In Shay's case, she actually leaves Kaikon. She goes to another country. She marries a non-Kaikonese man. She gets a business degree. You know, she wants to get away. She wants to be independent. But as circumstances require it and her family really needs her, she ends up coming back and exhibiting all the cunning and the loyalty and the fearlessness of all her heroic forebears.
It's been really fun to see the reader reaction to the different characters, because previously I had written books in which there's clearly one main character and you're following that character through the entire story. And what I loved about writing Jade City was that I had this tight-knit cast of characters that are family. And so you see them from different angles and from the points of view of other members in the family. And so I now get the pleasure of watching readers choose their favorites and argue about which character is their favorite. And some of them really, really love or dislike different characters. And so that's been fun. But Shay, yes, in particular, has I think a really strong emotional journey, because of, you know, she is the character who in many ways kind of embodies this pull towards another life or a modernization outside world, and yet is also very fiercely loyal to her family. And part of her character is due to the fact that you know, I've written a world that is very patriarchal and it's a very machismo kind of culture, and so it's not easy to be a woman greenbone in a society where you know, warrior prowess is revered and there's sort of patriarchal culture. And she is both very ambitious and very talented, and sort of chafes at like the constraints that she's had to deal with growing up. And so part of her desire to leave is trying to find a different way or get away from that. But you know, she's also she's also been raised in this, and when she comes back in to K-Con, it's not quite so easy to forget the fact that, you know, she's part of this family, this famous warrior family. So I think the dynamics between the siblings and the fact that they each have really sort of a different role to play was one of the fun parts about writing this book.
I was thinking maybe we could take a moment and talk about Anden as well, who is the adopted sibling. And he is clearly one of the most talented up-and-coming greenbones of his generation. And yet he also doesn't feel like he fits in. And there seem to be many reasons for this, because he was adopted by the Call family, because his mother killed herself, because he's gay. All those things weigh on him, which make for another internal conflict. All your characters, they're all so conflicted.
They are.
Internal conflicts. That's clearly something you're drawn to, though, I guess. And I guess any author, I mean, every character, we all have conflicts. So it's just a question of which ones you choose, I guess.
Right. Yeah, Anden is a character that is going to, not to have any spoilers for the rest of the series, is going to continue to be a major player, because he is clearly a talented greenbone in training and is beholden to this family that adopted him and took him in when he was orphaned. But he's also insecure and weighed down by kind of questions of, you know, does he belong, and is this the life he wants? And he's worried in particular for himself, because his mother didn't just kill herself. She suffered from the itches, which is a side effect of jade poisoning. And so he knows he has that genetic predisposition, and that is also something that he's worried about. So there's multiple reasons that Anden has some anxiety in his life. But he was also a good way for me as an author to show the environment of how, like, the Greenbones get trained. And because he spends a good part of the first of this book in the academy, where the Greenbones are trained to wear jade. So because he's not an adult yet, he's protected by the honor code that the Greenbones follow. And they have a sort of strict cultural stigma against those who wear jade harming or targeting those who don't. So as long as he's in the academy and he's not wearing jade, he is ostensibly not a target, is safe, if you will. Once he puts that jade on, he knows he will become a target, because he's this young, talented member of this family that is going into a war.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the blend of East and West in the story. As you say, K-Con had freed itself from a colonial power. I wonder, you know, how that inspired you. There isn't a lot of talk consciously about colonialism in the story. It's more background. So I wondered how that helped inform you and the story, and if there was any messages that you were trying to communicate.
So colonialism is a backdrop to the story, and I don't ever write anything with an explicit desire to send a message. I like to take inspiration from history and from things that exist in our own world, and try to create a secondary world that feels as absolutely grounded and real as I can possibly make it. I would like people to feel as if K-Con could be a real place, as if you could go to John Loon and walk the streets and touch the bricks. But I'm not trying to tell a story about colonialism. I'm trying to tell a story about the characters in this family. And the fact that colonialism is a part of the backdrop is largely because of the historical time frame that I set as an analog. So there were a couple of elements to that. One of the inspirations for the Kekkonese clans comes from the triads, which we now think of as a large Chinese organized crime group, but in their inception, they were not so. They were a secret society during the Qing Dynasty that opposed foreign governance and wanted to restore the Ming Dynasty. So they began as a resistance group. So that idea had some impact on the history that I built for the clans. And then I also wanted to set it in sort of latter half of the 20th century, because what's a gangster story without cars and Tommy guns and men in suits with murder on their minds? So I had a very clear aesthetic as to what the story would feel like, would look like. And many of the mafia stories that we have in America date to the 1920s, right? The Roaring Twenties, the 1950s, which was the heyday of the Five Families of New York. So periods of time in American history where there was a great deal of economic growth as well as social change. And in East Asia, that really kind of corresponded to a post-World War II economic boom. That was when there was a huge amount of economic growth and a reckoning with prior generations of colonialism and the growth of the Asian tiger, such as Singapore and Hong Kong and South Korea and Taiwan. So all those things kind of combined to make me want to create an aesthetic of a world that felt clearly East Asian, but in latter half of the 20th century, that was going through this growth, that had this history of oppression from foreign powers, and all that kind of mixed together as inspiration for KCON. I also think that all the kind of colonial cues and history and so on just give the fantasy world a sense of actual time. Oftentimes we read fantasy stories where it doesn't feel like the world has a particular sense of progress. Sometimes you read fantasy worlds where it's like there's elves and dwarfs and orcs and so on, but it's like it's always been that way. It's always been in this sort of medieval kind of milieu. And with where I was sitting in the historical analog that I was going to, I wanted KCON to feel like it had a real history. It had been through these different eras. It had gone through wars. It had gone through foreign occupation. It had achieved independence. So there's a sense of history and a sense of change.
What an amazing job you've done in world building, because you have touched on all these things. You've created a history, you've created a religion, you've created a culture, you've created a family history, and none of those things are ponderous in any way. They're all woven together very concisely, subtly, so that as a reader, I felt like I was learning about this world very easily. You made it go down very smoothly. And it felt very familiar in some ways, even though it's very different. So it's really quite an astounding feat, I think, you've achieved here. And my question is how you go about creating such an intricate world. And I read something you wrote where you answered a question that I don't know where I saw it now, where you said you couldn't have written Jade City as your first novel because it was just too complex. So I guess along the way in writing your first two books, you expanded your capacity to handle, what it is incredibly, truly a world. When people talk about world building, I guess some worlds are more intricate than others. So I'm just trying to imagine how you pull it together. Like, do you have a big chart on the wall with strings everywhere, like notes to yourself, and you make a glossary for all the terms, and here's the rule book for jade fighting, and I'm curious if there's a way you could impart some of, you know, your process.
I sometimes think that it's magic. When pressed to say, well, how did I do it? I look back and I'm not entirely sure. And yes, some combination of all those things. I definitely had charts. I had spreadsheets. I had files filled with scribblings and writings. I had lots of images and maps I had drawn and backstory that I had written. So yes to all of those things, but also just time and growth as a writer. I was writing other books while I was writing Jade City. From start to finish, I think Jade City took me about 3 years while I was also working on other projects. And I had in my mind an idea of what it would be, but it was I honestly didn't know if I had the chops to pull it off because it was such a ambitious project. And there were so many elements, and it was a complicated project. And then many times I put it aside for periods of time to work on other things, and then I would come back to it and I would just keep layering it in. It really was the sort of project you could not just write it from start to finish and then do another pass over and then call it done. There were so many passes over it, and layering on all the different pieces that I wanted to work into it. And trust me when I say that writing the second book is not any easier. I'm doing that right now, and it is still like the multi-sided Rubik's cube. I'm trying to fit together some jigsaw puzzle where I don't know what the final product looks like, and I have only the vaguest idea of even how many pieces there are going to be. And it's just this thing with all these, it's more akin to quilting than anything else. I'm trying to stitch it all into a coherent thing. So I would say definitely for me, it helped that I had written other novels. And in my case, I'd written young adult novels, which were more tightly focused. They're fast-paced, single character, points of view, and they really taught me to write with focus and to be tight and to keep the story moving. And that skill set helped me write Jade City, because it otherwise might have sprawled out of control.
And have you an outline for the next book? And there are going to be three, right?
There are going to be three, yes.
I mean, do you know how it ends? Is it, you know, clearly you're grappling with the inner workings of it, but I assume, and maybe you don't, have a complete vision for at least the big plot points.
Well, I do have a sense of where it's going, and I oftentimes when I write books, I need to know how it begins and I need to know how it ends, and I need to know some of the main markers along the way. And in the case of this trilogy, I do have a sense of where it's going, but that's not to say everything won't change and get blown up somewhere along the way. Having an outline, to me, gives me enough courage to dive into the swimming pool. Beyond that, I've never written a book where I stuck with the outline and finished it and was like, well, that outline fit perfectly. That's never happened. And I don't anticipate that'll happen this time either.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me about Jade City.
Thank you, Rob.
I've been speaking with Fonda Lee, author of Jade City. For more author interviews, check out the New Books Network. That's at newbooksnetwork.com. And click on the Science Fiction Show link, or you can subscribe to New Books in Science Fiction on iTunes, your favorite podcasting program or app. Our theme music is by Michael Aaron of quivernyc.com. The editor-in-chief of the New Books Network is Marshall Poe, and the editor is Leanne Wilson. And please don't forget to leave a review if you've liked today's show. I'm Rob Wolf, author of The Alternate Universe. You can find me on Twitter @RobWolfBooks. Thank you so much for listening to today's show.